So, welcome to a special edition of the Controversial Exchange Coronavirus Special. We just decided to get together real quick and put something, a quarantine reading list for our friends and fans out there, fellow behavior analysts out there, just trying to keep up their skills and keep engaged because boredom is dangerous, sedentary lifestyles emerge, and you might as well be doing something with your time other than playing video games, watching television, and eating Cheetos. So we thought, hey, what a great opportunity to catch up on some reading and talk about our favorite books, some books that we want to finish or we want to, and I don't know, it's a little bit of discussion to go with it. This is going to be a brief episode, but I hope that everybody takes this opportunity to increase their reading repertoires. And then I think that, Ryan, you had something you want to add?
Yeah, so first of all, I hope everyone's healthy, happy, as they can be in the situation. Best wishes, Godspeed to everyone, things like that. Of course, we are not talking on that for a few different reasons. Particularly, I'm working on setting up a webinar specific to behavior analysis and with a past guest on here, Tina Patterson. So she talked in episode 5, I believe, on mental health. She's done a lot of telehealth services. So when it comes to how this is impacting the ABA practitioner, clinician, RBT, BCBA, whatever, in the moment, regarding services and like what your day-to-day is like, we're gonna have an entirely separate discussion with someone that I think that's a little more well-positioned to have that. And then coincidentally, I'm gonna talk more data on a separate avenue later on Daily BA this week too. So the reason we're not talking specifically about that is there's plenty of that out there. And here's just a way to maybe spend your time if you have some time that you're looking to fill and further bettering yourself.
I will say I've always wanted to live through a post-apocalyptic action adventure, and I feel like this is the closest I'm going to get in my lifetime. So
it's nuts, man. it's insane.
Zombie apocalypse aside, did you see the Rogan with that epidemiologist guy?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and so maybe what we can do is we can
shit out of me.
Yeah, we'll link to that, and I guess a few other places to try to get some more informed perspectives, but yes.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I've always wanted to live through a zombie apocalypse just because it just seems like an exciting thing to do, and watching anarchy ensue is though it's terrifying, also exciting all at the same time. We'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah,
I'm just joking, folks. This is horrendous, it's tragic, and I can't, it's really sad and terrifying, so please, I was joking. Okay.
Danielle, I think this is because I haven't edited a past episode with you, so I think this is your first one like on air. Tell everyone what's up, what you do.
That it is the first one I've been on air. So I live in British Columbia, Canada, and I'm going to say like the landscape's a little different up here right now. I don't know if there's quite the same fear. There is the same toilet paper shopping and lack of that everywhere, but I'm in a pretty small town, so I haven't seen as much fear around all this yet. Although people are scared of me right now, as you can hear in my voice, I have had a cough for about a week, so who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, I provide rural services all over kind of British Columbia, Vancouver Island, Sunshine Coast. If we ever publish that other episode, there's a little bit more there.
Yes, we will. That's actually on my list of what to do over the next like 6 weeks. That's sooner, but like I've had a lot of canceled work, so I'm just going to work on catching up every single thing in my life, getting things out there. So super stoked to have you. Hope that cough doesn't develop into more. So today, Dimitri just texted and was like, hey, let's do something on reading lists. So why don't you go first, man? Set the pace.
Yeah, no problem.
What you want to do? Cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is like just off the top of my head, so I really didn't give this a ton of thought. But it was just more like, okay, what do I think are essential reading items that every behavior analyst, I think, should, or really every person should do if they're in a behavior realm or not. And I decided to make some specific decisions here and choices based on that. They're not anything special. Well, I guess I think some of them are special, but yeah. So I'm just going to go through the list and start, and then I'll just talk about each one. First and foremost, science and human behavior. This is... You know, Skinner's got a lot of writing. He's got Walden 2, Beyond Dignity Freedom, not to mention the countless articles and experimental books that have been produced about behaviorism. But Science of Human Behavior is like the first behavior book that I ever read that had just like such a beautiful narrative and explanation of behaviorism across every possible avenue of living and existence. And I really see it as a philosophical foundational book to understanding just what it is to be a behaviorist, what it is to understand and see the world through that lens, and to like take it on as almost like an ethos or like driving philosophy. So I think if you're a behavior analyst and you haven't read Science, Human Behavior, like get on it.
I totally agree. It's actually free from the B.F. Skinner Institute. So that's something that does not cost to be able to jump into.
Oh, there you go. I didn't even know that it was free. That's awesome. Second book here, I got Xingye Guo. I found out that the K is pronounced with a G. The Dynamics of Behavior Development. This book is fascinating for me personally, and actually was very helpful in an experimental class I recently took. It's kind of like the father of behavioral epigenetics. Not kind of, is the father of behavioral epigenetics and all the research that went along with that, including his life. It's a fantastic primer for starting to see behavior holistically and not just through that ontogenic lifespan layer, but also starting to see that evolutionary lens too and how that plays into it. So I think that, again, if you're looking for a complete picture and a holistic understanding of behavior, this is a clutch book. I know that Ryan also has a video that he's done on this, talking about it and from the early daily BA days. So highly recommend. Next, Learning in Complex Behavior by Donahoe and Palmer. Again, we talked about this a couple episodes ago. This book took me over a year to read. It is brutal in terms of difficulty. So this is probably not necessarily the light reading portion of it, but it's definitely one worth like leveraging one or two chapters and then going into Science of Human Behavior for your candy and your reinforcer. Because again, if we're talking about understanding behavior from that holistic, multi-leveled, multi-layered, molar view perspective, as Baum would put it, this is a key primer in that. It's a little older now, so there might be some things in it that are slightly out of date, but honestly, 98.9% of it is good to go, and it's fantastic and unbelievable, unbelievable book. And then the next set... Man, I feel like I'm going through this kind of fast, but we want this to be kind of quick.
I think it's good, man. Yeah.
You'll see here is Izzy Gold Diamond's Blue Books. Now, you're seeing these. If you see the video, you'll notice that I have spiral bound versions of them. These do not exist out in the wild, as these are not in print. This is me going to Staples and spending $180 to have the PDF printed and spirally bound for me and then placed with different color backs.
I will say that you're in a small group of people that do have printed ones, because he did print and hand them out to a few of his students.
Okay, let me put it like, you can't get that shit.
Yeah. Well, what's cool is you're now in this like super elite dope club of people that have printed copies on their shelf, man.
Yeah, it was $180 to print all this shit. It was definitely a vanity exercise just to say
worth
it. But
it
was worth every second of it.
Fun fact, the Blue Books. Fun fact.
But the Blue Books... for those who are wondering, and we talk about the Blue Books all the time, but in terms of a functional analysis of behavior, a comprehensive understanding of like introductory ideas, philosophy of science, just pretty much like a practitioner's guide to the galaxy. I mean, this is no offense to the White Book. Like, obviously, that's a great introductory textbook, etc. This is much more concrete and substantive, in my opinion, and a lot less just introductory.
I've only read the first little bit, and it's like, it's just the way it's written is, it makes so much more sense when you're just being introduced to this stuff.
Oh yeah, you did read some of it, did you?
Yeah. Daniel?
Awesome. Yeah, you liked it, huh?
Yeah.
Why have we not talked about
there's,
this?
There's different ways to introduce the science of behavior, and I got to say that guy did it very well in a very different way. Mm-hmm. I loved it.
Oh, dude, this is. Best reference material on the planet, period. Exclamation point. All right, next books. So the last four on my list are actually, well, one of them's semi-behavioral. The two of them are semi-behavioral, I guess, are kind of like side projects, or like just non-behavioral, but I think are really good for reading if you're not really looking to just dive into behavior stuff. The first one is The Eden Conspiracy, Educating for Accomplished Citizenship by Joe Harless. This book is on education reform. It was written in 97, and it exists because Carl Binder made it so and worked with the Cambridge Center to make it happen. But above all, it's kind of a way to evaluate what does education look like if we're programming for outcomes rather than looking at just I don't know, creating automatons from a system designed for the
agrarian age. I have to say,
age.
Though, it's a frustrating book to read because it's older and everything in it still applies. So it is frustrating.
I know, dude. This book is crazy, right? You're like, this is almost 30 years ago, and holy shit, all of it's still good. All of it still makes sense.
So if you want to rage, read that
does
book.
Does it hold in relation to the Canadian landscape too?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Dude, it's, I mean, yeah, Money in the Bank. Next book is, this is called Behave by Robert Sapolsky. This book is something that I read on a recommendation from a friend. I listened to it first, and then after listening to it, I was like, I didn't understand that. So then I had to go back, and I actually read the paper copy of it because I had to actually have the words in front of me. This one took me about, I want to say, 90 days of like really giving it some love. So this is also not for the faint of heart. It's an 8 million page book, and it's highly technical. But what's cool about it is that it's a beautiful blend of neuroscience and modern psychology and modern behaviorism all kind of wrapped into a thing. So it doesn't come from a radical perspective. It comes much more from a neuroscientific perspective. But again, it brings in those biological components and it gets you kind of understanding the physiology and the mechanics behind things a little bit and gives a little bit of additional context there. Obviously, I think that generally the theme of the book is a little misguided because it emphasizes mechanism. So if you're going to read this through a behavior analytic lens, make sure you're looking at it in terms of like reading it critically in that way. But just raw information, holy smokes, man. Like, it's just a great book for that.
I will note that if you can't afford, again, on this one specifically, he has a YouTube series. I believe it was set up as like one of those massively open online courses, MOOCs, through somewhere. So you can go onto YouTube and listen to him speak for, I don't quote me on this, but I think upwards of like 10 hours on this topic.
That's pretty cool.
As well. Yeah.
Awesome. Next book is, this is a personal book I put into here. It's like old as hell too. This is Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. This is my one philosophy plug I'm going to put in there. What's fascinating about this book is that it wasn't supposed to exist. Marcus Aurelius was known as the last great emperor. He's featured in that movie Gladiator. And he used to carry a trunk with him across all of his campaigns and stuff that had all his writings and personal thoughts in them. And upon his death, the trunk was, he had ordered his servants to destroy it because he didn't want to have his personal thinking out there. He's considered what's called a Roman Stoic. And all of this is basically a root of Stoic philosophy. And what happened was, upon opening the chest and reading the wisdom of the beloved emperor, and they couldn't bring themselves to destroy his words, so they put it in publication, and it's become a classic. I think if you're looking to live the well-examined life, I think this is worth exploring and reading. The first chapter of it is him just going through and demonstrating gratitude to everyone who's ever impacted his life, from his servants all the way down to the lowly peasants that he's ever encountered, all the way up to kings and queens. So it just shows what someone who was the equivalent of a god in their time could still demonstrate and exhibit humility. It was just a fantastic read if you're looking for some like guidance and personal development stuff. and then finally, a newer book, on similar vein, if you're looking for something a little more, just a little more for your spirit rather than for your intellectual pursuits, not that this isn't intellectual, but, is Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. Highly recommend. Again, this is just a story of his life. And, he's a guy who's a Navy SEAL, ultra marathon runner, just like all around exceptional human. He is arguably the toughest person on the planet, X period. Like, no yeah. questions. Like, it's not like the man is capable. He's demonstrated the breadth of human potential, in my opinion.
I think there's
his story is so compelling.
I think there's contenders if you look at certain threads, right? So if you look at like distance runners that go 200 mile runs, if you go like Navy SEALs, the crazy thing about him is that the breadth of different things that he's done
does it all.
Yeah.
Did it all. Actually, I would not recommend the paper copy of this book. I would recommend the audiobook for this too. So if you're on the go, the audiobook is actually better because the audiobook is done podcast style, where him and his ghostwriter, the ghostwriter reads it because he has dyslexia and he has trouble. It was a stutter, so he has difficulty reading. So his ghostwriter reads it, and at the end of each chapter, they do kind of like a 10 or 15 minute back and forth, just podcast reflecting on that chapter and him kind of adding context. It's unbelievable. This book has all the facts in this book have been vetted. This is his life. You will not believe what this man has survived and what he's been through and the journey. So I highly recommend it. Anyway,
yeah, you've got those are at least two grown men on this podcast that cried while reading it or listening.
Dude, I literally broke down in tears. Like, this book made me cry. No,
yeah, it's insane.
Not even like I'm getting actually a little choked up thinking about his just because he, I don't know. You don't really think about how special certain people are. And you don't really think about the human potential that's there for everybody if they really want to dig deep and show that. And this guy illuminates that, and he just really, really gives context to what's possible. So, yeah, amazing book. So
he's been on Joe Rogan Experience. So, again, you can get tidbits of this freely if you can't afford it.
Yeah, he's done the podcast scene. So even if you don't want to listen to the book, you could find him on Rogan. You can find him on Impact Theory. You can find him on School of Greatness. You can find him on a bunch of different other podcasts. Where he's done that. All right.
That you want to go, Danielle?
That's all she wrote there.
Sure. Mine's pretty short because I realized that over the last two-ish years, I've really only been reading boring books for our program. Like, for example, this Catania book, just the fifth edition of Learning, which is actually one of the better ones. It's more of a... like a story about behavior analysis. So it's kind of a nice way of presenting everything, but really it's just textbooks and textbooks and textbooks. So I have a huge to read list. Some of the ones that I'd like to read would be Coercion and Its Fallout by Sidman. I haven't read that one yet.
That's on my list. Coercion and Its Fallout.
And then quite a few related to RFT and ACT. Like, I haven't read Hayes's new A Liberated Mind. I started The Happiness Trap a couple years ago, and then I loved it so much that I started lending it out and I never got it back. So I need to finish that by Russ Harris. The new one, The Evolution of Contextual Behavior Science with Sloan Biglin and Hayes. I'd like to read that.
That's money.
And then this episode's not released yet, but the cultural episode that you guys are releasing, The Changing Cultural Practices by Anthony Biglin. I'd like to read that.
Cool. So that'll be out next week from this date, actually. So that's already scheduled in the hopper.
And then The Nurture Effect. I've been meaning to read that for a while, too.
I've enjoyed that. Biglin has this, he's not a behavior analyst. He might as well be. He behaves as one. But he's got this really cool intersection of policy, cultural level, individual, behavior. Like, he's hung around with behavior analysts for like at least the last 25 years, 30 years. So it's just, I don't know. I don't try to put people on pedestals, but he's one of those guys. It's like, I look up to you because of the breadth of knowledge that you bring to a situation.
And the ability to possibly influence, public policy. Like, he's really,
they've successfully done that. And that's part of it is they've actually shown how they've had policy changes in the state of Oregon where he resides. So yeah.
Wow. Nurture Effect's a great book. Highly recommend for sure.
I'm kind of saving it as like one day when I'm kind of in a low and I need some motivation, I'll try and read that.
I actually use that. I use that as a parent recommendation actually, because it's written in such an accessible way that if I encounter a parent who's looking for some like advice on how to function in their lives, learn more about the field, I send them to The Nurture Effect.
That's a good idea. I send people to The Happiness Trap because nice, for similar reasons.
Yeah.
And then based on our EAB class and some of our other classes, I really have enjoyed the behavioral economics piece of research. And so there's a couple that I'd like to read around that. Like, one's called Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics by Richard Thaler. And then Freakonomics by Stephen Levitt. I think that would be good too.
Oh, Freakonomics is money. Freakonomics also has a documentary that highlights the key portions of the book, mm-hmm. and they also have a podcast.
Aha.
So Freakonomics is awesome. Very cool.
He's
very
also
cool
been on,
science-based
he's,
thing.
He's done a whole host of podcasts out there too, so you can get different interviews of him by different top folks as well.
Absolutely.
Sweet.
And then the last one is The Science of Consequences by Susan Schneider. And I actually don't really know exactly what that one is about because I forgot, but it was on my Goodreads to read list and it looks really good. So it's got
that's
a high
amazing.
Rating.
And what is cool about hers is it's another, I kind of think about it to tie into Dimitri's and Biglin and this other stuff is a beginning to understanding the breadth of human behavior and really behavior in its totality when it comes across species. So
She spoke at ChatCon, right?
Yeah. So the science of consequences is, in a sense, a little misleading because it's the science of just the entire contingency and what's going on there. So she brings in epigenetic, behavioral, historical, like ecological. Like she'll just bring in all these different variables and kind of explain them. It's in a pretty consumable way, I would say, more so for like science-minded folks. I would not hand something like this to a parent. But anybody that's like, I want to dive into this, it's really a pretty consumable thing of what you might end up getting. Like if you were to look at learning complex behavior that Dimitri mentioned or the learning chapter that you mentioned, like they're kind of like condensed starters of that. And in some ways more up to date too. She's fantastic. Such a kind human too.
Oh, she was really lovely to see at ChatCon.
Sweet. Okay. So I'll jump into some that I have. To start, I have a number of these. If you don't know, you haven't listened to me talk about things before, I'm super biased with Context Press. It's a press that published a lot of different things under Stephen Linda Hayes' guidance. I believe they owned it together originally. It's now part of, I think, New Harbinger, if I'm correct.
Wow.
And so just kind of throwing that out there. Yeah.
That's legit. This,
well, when, yeah, so okay. I guess the quick story on that was
someone got paid.
They realized that nobody was necessarily going to want to listen on like a mass scale of what they had to say because of their very small niche. So they self-published for some 15, 20 years. And then when the opportunity came because of the eyeballs, the growth of the field, what happened is they ended up being acquired by New Harbinger as a result, as a kind of cool dissemination strategy. I don't think this was ever realized or it was maybe a wish or whatnot, but what happened was they were put in the shelves of like a bunch of major distributors as a result of that acquisition. So this is when Steve Hayes's Get Out of Your Mind, Get Into Your Life was on a bunch of the different bookshelves nationally when he went to like a Barnes & Noble because New Harbinger had that relationship. So part of the reason there's been millions of copies read was because of this press in a sense and like them realizing that they needed to put these paper or these words down somewhere. So anyhow, really cool. First of all, they have one that's called The History of Behavioral Therapies, Founders Personal Histories. These sort of things are kind of like that Cambridge Center book on that they have talking about different tales of inspiration. And what is cool about these is you just get to hear how things developed, their histories, what potentially may be influencing not only behavioral theories and therapies, but also just getting some of the context of the history as to like what maybe was going on politically or I guess across camps when it comes to different ways of thinking about psychology. Also from Context Press, Rule Governed Behavior, this purple book. Admittedly, I've not finished it. I've read parts of it. Again, they were looking for a place to talk about rule governed behavior research on it. It's in a sense very, it even looks very similar to like learning and learning in complex behavior, right? It's almost exactly a very similar format of just talking chapter by chapter of the different implications. Yeah, you've got a hard copy. Sick, man.
First edition.
Yeah.
No big deal.
To kind of continue down this path, if anyone's not read into Learning RFT, the Tornike book, and especially if you don't understand RFT, this is your first stop. If you're dealing with a verbal organism at any point in your life, this is something you should be reading. If not, your practitioner skill sets are going to be lacking to some degree, most likely. Like, I don't find how you can't enter in another perspective of that at this point, given the state
it's
of our
field. It's an easy read, too. That's yes. An easy read. Like,
it is
that
an easy
is, like,
read,
doable.
But you can read it over and over and get something new from it every time, too.
For sure. For sure.
Nicholas Tornike is an MD, actually. So it's pretty cool that you're hearing about it by an expert that learned about it as a doctor rather than somebody that came from our field too.
I think Russ Harris was that too, because yes.
I'm gonna actually,
sorry Daniel,
since I actually mentioned the Tales of Behavioral Discoveries, I'm gonna pull that one. So since I actually mentioned that Behavioral Science Tales of Inspiration and Discovery, I'm gonna show that one instead. I was going to talk more about RFT stuff, but if you're looking for that, there's a number of different extensions of that book. So after the original 2001 learning book, or sorry, 2001 relational frame theory book has an extension as well. So if anybody's like looking for those, you can go find those. To kind of keep on the Murray Sidman track, Tactics of Scientific Research by him is one of my favorites. If I had one... Yeah, Dimitri's got it. If I had one or two that books that I had to like only bring with me forever, this would be one of them for sure. Just because of his way of trying to share how you can come to understand human behavior regardless of what your question is and how to approach it. And so many of the methods books and things that are a little bit admittedly tougher to usually get through were really formed off of the logic in this book.
Yeah.
100%. Like this was the Bible for anybody that was writing a methods book. It's 100% applicable still today. And
This is like the proto narrative, like story version of that Brown Pennypacker book that everybody has to have, you know?
Yeah. And like you could straight up learn how to design methods based off of this. It's what they call single case logic, which is teaching the logic as to how approach researching questions, whereas almost everyone in our field learns designs and strengths and weaknesses of them. So I have always personally thought that it's a very weak skill set that you develop with how it's usually taught in our programs. And if you learn the case logic, it makes more sense.
Murray Sidman's on the fucking Mount Rushmore of what we do, bro. He is epic.
Next one is Understanding Behavior Disorders. This was published again by Context Press. It's 2007, so it's quite out of date relative to everything that's come up that's new in those sort of regards. But what I really like about it is if you're looking for like a contemporary behavioral perspective into mental health issues, behavioral mental health issues. So you're saying we're getting out of autism, intellectual disabilities, the areas that we're typically used to being competent and working in as board certified behavior analysts. This is usually my go-to of something to start stepping into and reading. You're going to get things not only in how you look at these as a behavioral perspective, but you want to talk about OCD, anxiety, trichotillomania, psychotic disorders, addiction, different I would say labels of that nature. This is your go-to.
What's that one called again?
It is Understanding Behavior Disorders by Woods and Kanter, k-a-n-t-e-r, not to be mistaken for Kantor, who I'm about to bring up. Actually, it's pretty rad, man. You'll love it.
I've only read a whole book list right now on Amazon as
you both went through your lists.
You've both named things I don't have.
The next one, J.R. Kantor. He was actually before Skinner's days in a sense. I would say adjacent to Skinner in the development of behaviorism. He was not as publicly known, I guess, and especially nowadays, but I would say holds equally to the amount of thinking and what was going on at the time period in the development of behaviorism. The Logic of Modern Science, I would say, is the best way to start. Kind of an introduction to what we talk about being interbehaviorism, which at its core is just really understanding that all of these variables interplay and interact with one another when it comes to our learning history, the modality of how we interact with things, genetics, etc. And so he was really trying to focus on a conceptual model that would take that into account. And what I mean by that is if you're used to the four-term contingency, the three-term contingency, he was like, how do we make sure that all the variables that usually are labeled context are actually representative in this model so that we can look at them and analyze them? So it's carried on by folks like Ed Morris, Linda Hayes. There's some folks in the Chicago School of Professional Psychology as well. Oh my gosh, Mitch Freiling. I was blanking on his name for a second, but there's some folks out there that write on that perspective still, if you're looking for things to dig into. Three more. One that I think is an oldie goodie, again, on kind of methods, but not as much. Also, it kind of is, I don't know, The Scientist Practitioner. And this was written by a number of different people, Steve Hayes, Dave Barlow, and Rosemary Nelson Gray. I think about this as like part methods book, which a lot of us have probably gone through to different capacities, and it is treated like a textbook in the sense. But what's cool is he situated it in the medical model. So when you see like places like the Association of Contextual Behavioral Science talking about ACT and the different randomized control trials they've done and such, they've done somewhere crazy now, I want to say like around 400 RCTs of that nature. And they're doing them in places like the Veterans Affairs and different large scale systems like this. And the part of the reason is they understand that that camp, how to situate those in our society and how to get them done. So where we're lacking, I would say, is traditional behavior analysts with a lot of different areas of research outside the single subject area. This is kind of your book to go learn about that. And in a sense, they really called it 20, 30 years before the medical model has really hit us hard and influencing us. Last two, if you have not read it, Let Me Hear Your Voice, A Family's Triumph Over Autism. It's a big reason as to why our field is so represented day to day and the work that we do. Catherine Maurice just wrote a fantastic book about the perspective of learning that her child was diagnosed with autism, what that meant, how they went about assessing and eventually finding evidence-based practice, why they valued it. And I'll kind of leave it there. I don't want to have any spoilers. It's written as like a narrative, and it is fantastic. We owe a lot to her. Last one. We at one point did an episode kind of talking about some of these sort of things, but Houston, We Have a Narrative. This is definitely one of my most marked up books because I've been doing a lot. I'm trying to understand how to bring this into podcasting videos, things like that. Randy Olson, a marine biologist, I believe it was marine biology, was a specialty, that was in academia, dropped, left his tenure track profession to run into LA and go to film school at USC and try to understand how we could disseminate things outside of a non-academia sort of setting of publishing and such. So it's this journey of that. It was recommended to me after I started playing around with video, podcast, stuff like that. And it's, I would say, a story of his first 20 or 30 years of that journey of after he left and how he's approaching it. Really now what's going on is they're trying to figure out what are the best methods to really get this going on. So if anyone's interested in an area of like science communication, dissemination, those are the sort of keywords. This is Outside the Field of Behavior Analysis. Fantastic resource to read and understand about how other sciences are trying to essentially disseminate their findings more accurately in consumable sort of ways. So hopefully that wasn't more than my sort of 10 minutes, but
no.
That's what I've got.
Question. I've got a question for both of you though, because some of these books are pretty dense and like that one you have all marked up. So do you guys have any tips for like how people should go about reading these?
100%. I don't know if any of this is empirically validated, but what I was taught, what I keep going on with is read a couple things at the same time, actually. Read something that is like easy to consume, understand, maybe even has immediate practical use in your life, something you can employ the next day or that day. And then pair that with something that you're reading as well that is that super dense, super hard to get through just because of, the type of information, lack of history with that sort of subject or that part of that subject. And so it was basically kind of setting up this read one of the hard, dense chapters, reward, air quotes, with one of the easier chapters, kind of hop back and forth. I didn't follow that super strictly. Like if I was super into one of the book chapters and I kept me turning pages, I would just keep going. But I'd make sure that I wasn't neglecting the harder things to understand by that strategy. And that's how I got through almost every single philosophy book that I've come to value. It was not easy. Because the implications are harder to see or like use in your day to day, I think. But that's been my strategy.
Mine is a little more visceral than that. I try to like And we talked about this a little bit in the episode we did talking about critical thinking and the research evaluation. But I take the same approach to all the reading that I do, honestly, with the exception. Actually, no, I even kind of do this when I'm reading fiction even. It's more like I look for total immersion and I try to like be in that world, like immerse yourself in that moment, in the words, into the imagery. And I try to really visualize what I'm reading, not just seeing words for information, and kind of create, yeah, create an experiential, like visceral connection to the words. And it kind of has this like respondent, this respondent effect where like you can almost see it and feel it and really hold on to it a lot longer. Again, there's no evidence, but I'm just saying this is what I do and what works for me. I think that my biggest advice would just be like, if you're not a big reader and you wish you were, right? And that's fine. I did not start out a reader. I think what turned me into a reader was the momentum that comes with finishing a book and the feeling that you get from it and the joy you get from it. The first book series I read at like 15, because I was, you know, English is a second language student at the time, so like my reading wasn't the best, so reading for fun really wasn't in the cards. It wasn't something that I was jacked about. It was Tom Harris's Hannibal Lecter series. And looking back on it, those three books, Silence of the Lambs, Red Dragon, and Hannibal, set me on a path of like becoming a person who loves to read. So yes, I would say this, is that if the books that we've suggested sound like a living nightmare to you, don't read them. Like, instead, pick something that is going to bring you joy. I also had a kiddie lit addiction. So like, I love Harry Potter and Percy Jackson and the Olympians, and I love fiction. I unfortunately don't have time to read physics anymore, which is, you know, words on a page are just so much more satisfying. And I think, create the conditions of imagination and creative thinking and inspiration, that Netflix and chill just doesn't do. And again, that sounds kind of like, not to be like an old fart about it, but because I mean, I Netflix and chill with the best of them. But I mean, like, there's just something about holding a book in your hand and taking it from beginning to end and just experiencing that moment. It's really a beautiful thing. And since we're going to have some time on our hands, it's the best time to do it.
Do you have best anything, time to Danielle, give it a that helps you get through them?
I set up like the contextual cues to get me in the mood for reading. So I don't have a bath anymore, but when I had a bathtub, I would always read in the bath. And that was like my way of mindfully reading. I also do like have a couple different books going at a time, but I find that if I can't get into it in the first two chapters or something, I'll switch to something else. And that keeps the momentum going.
That was part of my problem with the philosophy books, is it was like, I know this is like, I would talk with mentors and I'd start to see the applications of it, but it was like, I could never get, you know, that cadence with like any of the book chapters. Like it would just like stop. So I just was like, all right, I'm going to do a chapter, call it good, read something I'm loving, back forth.
And
back
what,
forth,
what forth. Is the book that gave you the most pause?
The most pause, and like it was really hard to read?
Yeah.
Probably one called Varieties of Scientific Contextualism. And essentially...
Sounds like a bruiser.
Yeah, essentially. What the difference was between Skinner, the folks that are in the RFT sort of camp of functional contextualism and such, and the different implications of that. People don't know that like... there's documented like some 20 plus different forms of behaviorism, and there's small little different intricacies between them. That one is basically covering a bunch of those little different differences, and essentially trying to make grounds for and arguing why functional contextualism matters. And that's where when people critique RFT and these other things, it's like, well, you really got to dive in further and further, further back to be able to make those arguments. So while when I was reading more things and I was running into issues, that's where those sort of things became more valuable. But yeah, man, I remember the truth chapter. I read like 5 times in a row on my stoop in Florida. It was like an hour to get through the chapter. I wrote it 5 times back to back, and I learned a lot. But also, I was like, "Why? Like what?" Like, just so hard.
That's when you know you got something good, though.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
I think reading one chapter at a time is a good idea too for the dense ones, because if you read too much, you don't really have the opportunity to apply it because you're flooded with information. So I'm finding that in the program that you get flooded with so much that you can't apply it all, which makes it harder to learn. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
All right, I think that's it, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Can you look up real quick what the Flat Earth Society's at real quick for us?
Of course, please, yes. Marvelous.
I will reiterate while he's looking that up that Tina Patterson, she's a BCBA. She's been on here in the past, episode 5. You want to get to know her a bit. It looks like 10 a.m. Central or 8 a.m. Pacific this Tuesday, March 17th is when we will be holding the webinar on essentially telehealth behavior analysis, kind of what's going on with this outbreak of COVID-19. And so if you're looking for that, the link will be shared widely on different social platforms to be able to like sign up and be able to attend and whatnot. So yeah.
All right. And on that note, the Flat Earth Society is officially 210,000 likes on Facebook, up 2,000 since the last time we checked. So
the virus has rocked their world.
To the controversial exchangers out there, we got to get it together. And actually, hold on, I want to see the space is fake from last time too. I looked that up, by the way, Ryan. And
if you're new here, this is a recurring theme that we look at just to see how fast things are growing in the world outside of science.
Oh, that one's not crushing as much. It's called... fake NASA. Lies. 5.7 thousand people. Oh, goodness. Oh, man.
This I love this world.
Oh, my God. Zombie. You know what? We need a good zombie
Pastafarians and all these good things.
It's interesting. All right, I think that's it, yeah? We've officially
officially broken, yeah.
Okay. And as always, marvelous, right?
Marvelous.
Bye. Hey, friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple, and it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.